Hi, everybody. This is Greg Kelly, host of this podcast and also a TV show that I highly recommend. It's Greg Kelly Reports on Newsmax Television at 7 p.m. East Coast time. Figure it out for the rest of the country. I think that's 4 o'clock in California. Anyway, you heard about that Bob Woodward book that comes out or came out a few weeks ago. It says a lot of nasty things about President Trump. I think it took a heck of a lot out of context, especially those audio tapes. He's got, something like 18 hours of tape, and you release 4 minutes of the conversation. By definition, a lot of that stuff is going to be out of context. I've never really liked Bob Woodward, going back to, my experience and my knowledge of the Watergate case. Watergate is fundamentally misunderstood by basically everybody. Number one, Woodward and Bernstein did not dethrone President Nixon. They leaked some stuff or reported some leaks from grand jury testimony. That's what they really did that got them attention back in, 73, 74. And then they wrote a lot of fiction, including the fiction that Deep Throat contacted Woodward in the manner he did, and those underground garage moments. Here's the deal. They were writing a book in 1973-74, All the President's Men, that they had no idea people would be reading decades later in journalism classes and seeing it as a classic of some kind. They were writing a book for a quick buck, and the publishing industry was thriving in the early 70s, and people were reading books. So they had to make a boring story more interesting. And that's why and how they invented this Deep Throat character. And think about it for a second. Deep Throat. Deep Throat was the name of a pornographic movie. Linda Lovelace was the actress who portrayed Deep Throat. So if you're going to say that Mark Felt, who they later outed as Deep Throat, was a hero, why would you give a hero such a horrible name, Deep Throat? You know, we know what Deep Throat connotes, and it makes no sense that Mark Felt is a hero and they called him Deep Throat. There are so many inconsistencies. So I know that they were lying about that. I also know, and a lot of other people know, that Woodward was lying when he said he had a deathbed interview with William Casey, the late great CIA director under Ronald Reagan in the late 1980s. So Casey figured prominently in the Reagan administration and also in discussions during the Iran-Contra affair and over the Iran-Contra affair. It's a little bit complex, but there's a book called Veil by Bob Woodward, and in it, he has this preposterous interview with William Casey on his deathbed. And according to Woodward, he confesses that he had knowledge of the Iran-Contra affair all along, the diversion of money, illegal diversion of money to the Nicaraguan Contras who were fighting the Sandinistas. Now, that all seems obscure right now, but back then, that was a major, major deal. And if Casey knew about it, well, that would prove that he was involved in something illegal. Anyway, the way it comes out in the book is nonsense. A lot of people noticed it at the time, actually, were suspicious of it. Casey's widow came out very, very aggressively and pushed back on the story, saying, Woodward, there was no way he was in the hospital room. It's totally impossible that he was in the hospital room. And I remember that. It was in the late 1980s, and she did so much media that I remember her and her pushback. So Bob Woodward comes out with this book, Rage About Donald Trump, and the media are buying it hook, line, and sinker. I remember this episode, which is always, anytime I hear about Bob Woodward, I think about that, and I think about his lies about that interview and his lies about Deep Throat. So I thought about it, and while that conversation is happening, although it's mostly over by now, but I wanted to revisit that issue. So I tracked down William Casey's daughter, Bernadette Casey Smith, a great woman who knows all about this case and was very close to her father. And we had a beautiful chat about this and other subjects.
Where were you born?
I was born in... Mom was pregnant in Washington. Dad was working down there. And then she wanted to come home to have the baby. So I was born in Hempstead, Long Island.
Do you know what... Were you not Mercy Hospital by any
Mercy.
Chance? Really?
Mercy. Mm-hmm.
I grew up about 3 miles from there in Garden City.
Oh, really? Uh-huh.
And you were an only child, correct?
Yes. We lived in Garden City for, I guess, 4 years, and then we came over here.
What street on Garden City do you remember?
Foxbury Road.
No kidding. Wow, I know exactly where that is.
Yep.
And what when you were born, you mentioned your dad was in D.C., you came back as a family, but what
was he? I was 6 months old, and my dad went to the service.
Oh, and he went into the Navy or OSS?
The Navy and then OSS.
All right, so a little bit on him. He was born in Queens, correct?
Yes.
And do you know about his childhood, what kind of childhood he had?
I just know little stories here and there. He was, first of all, he was a very big child. He didn't start walking until he knew how to walk, and then he got up and walked. Just to tell us a little bit about his character. And he figured it out, and then he got up and did it. He had a brother and sister. Where were they born?
Jackson Heights?
No, Astoria.
Astoria.
And then they came out to Long Island, and they moved to Belmore. And then there's another legend or story that he went to St. Agnes, and he didn't like that at all because they didn't have sports. So finally went to the public school. In St. Agnes, he was sitting in class, a Latin class, and the teacher said, "Casey, you're not paying attention." And Dad said, "Yes, I am." He stood up and he verbatim told her exactly what she was reading. So he had a photographic memory from very early on.
I've heard this before, that he was extraordinarily bright, very, very intelligent. Did he receive any academic awards in high school or anything like that you know of?
Never talked about it.
Why did he go to Fordham?
Fordham?
Yeah.
Because at that time his father passed, and he was actually taking care of the family. So he could be a day student at Fordham.
Hey, by the way, I don't know if you know this, but Donald Trump went to Fordham for 2 years. Did you know that?
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah, 2 years, and then he transferred to the University of Pennsylvania. It's been in the news lately. His niece has written a book claiming that he cheated on a test to get in. I've looked into that. It's totally impossible. It makes absolutely no sense. But the news...
I think there's a part of the family that are a little jealous of his success.
Yeah, you can see that. Lots of families have all kinds of complexities. Mm-hmm. So he went off to the Navy and World War II and OSS. Did he talk about his time in the military much?
No. Not at all.
You're growing up, you mentioned first, in Garden City, and then you moved to the house you're in right now?
When I was 5 years old.
Now, can I just ask you, what is that like? Is that the only home you've lived in your entire life?
Yeah. Pretty well, until I got married, and then we had a house, and then we bought another house. And when Mom passed, we came here.
That's an unusual experience these days. You know what I mean? People move 10, 15 times, and that's wonderful.
We were a very close nuclear family. Both sides of the family, actually. My mother's more so, because her family came and moved into, there's five houses here. So they moved into some of the outer houses. But we were very close to Dad's side also.
So while you're growing up there, first of all, where did you go to school? Where did you go to, grade school and high school?
I went to the parochial Catholic school in Roslyn, St. Mary's. And then I went off to Brentwood, the Academy of St. Joseph's. And I wanted to go there because they had horseback riding. So I could go horseback riding every day. Forget about the academics. I just wanted to go for the horses.
That's quite a trip from Roslyn, isn't it?
Oh, I was a boarder.
Oh, you lived there. Okay.
I was a boarder here.
And your father, as you're growing up, what was his occupation for the most part?
I'm going to put, do you mind if I put my husband, I put this on speaker so
sure.
He can fill in, as we're a very unlikely couple, not unlikely, but unusual. My husband worked for Dad.
Oh.
So he knew Dad as an employee first, and then they both lived on Long Island, and they became very, very friendly. So he was like a friend. He couldn't say this is my son-in-law because this is my friend Owen Smith. So so he knows a lot of the business kind of side of his years.
But just generally, what would you say? Like, if somebody asked you when you were a kid, what did your father do for a living? What would you say?
Lawyer.
And and more specifically, securities and financial type.
I'd just say lawyer.
Right. When did he get involved with politics?
Politics, Dewey. Probably Dewey was the first one.
Thomas Dewey, the governor of New York. When he ran for president?
The president. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Well, he was always involved in local politics. There's some newspaper clippings around here that he was at some sort of club and all that sort of stuff. When he was younger.
After
Dewey, I think he's just really, other than sending a check here or there, he would only get involved in the presidential elections.
And before
or congressional in the area.
Did he ever run for Congress? Somehow I thought
He did. He ran in 1966.
And what do you remember of that campaign? He lost, right?
He lost, yeah.
What happened?
He was kind of a renegade. He was running against the Republican Party. And he lost. But I was very much involved in that campaign because I was in my 20s then. So I was on the campaign trail, and we had a heck of a good time, but we didn't win.
He was running against an incumbent Republican?
Yeah, Darunian, who won, and then he lost to Lester Wolf. And Lester Wolf always said he was so thankful for Dad, because otherwise he probably wouldn't have won. But that's the way it is. And then Dad, after he lost, he said, oh, thank God. because really going around and promoting himself was not part of his MO. He didn't like, he wasn't fond of doing that.
And in 1966, he's 50 something, right? He's not a kid. He's not, but
not a kid, no.
Yeah.
No. Well, he said you don't go to Washington unless you're substantial. That you don't have to get anything from Washington. And I think the piece that you did about Trump saying that, you know, he being president, he's not getting anything from it. I really like that segment of your program. And that's where you know, Dad felt about going to Washington.
You have to be
substantial and be able to, you know, say what you want to say, and nobody can push you around.
So he was at that point, he had established himself, he was wealthy, and he had his reputation. He wasn't a young man on the make. He had already made it.
Mm-hmm.
And that's interesting. And then it was time.
Even before that, he said when he came back from the service, because he liked Washington and Mom liked Washington. He said, "You know, how come you're not going to stay in Washington?" He said, "You don't stay in Washington unless you're substantial, and you know, you can stand on your own two feet. You don't want to be a newcomer in Washington."
No, that makes a lot of sense. By the way,
and I never understood that, and he never explained why. But you can see why today.
Sure. does the name John Wilder, Congressman John Wilder?
John Wilder, yeah, sure.
Did you know
him? I'm gonna put you. Yeah, Owen knows John very well. Hold on.
Okay.
Where's the speak one? Is it? Did I get you?
Yeah, I hear you.
Okay, Greg, I wanted to introduce you to my husband Owen Smith, who spent many years in as a what was your title?
Well, I know.
In Congress and the Senate.
What?
New York Senate.
Oh, New York Senate. I was counsel to State Senator Ralph Marino.
Oh, I remember the name Marino very well. So, hello, Mr. Smith. I would like to ask you several questions, and then if you don't mind, in a few minutes, we'll go back. We'll take it off speaker because the audio isn't terribly, it just kind of is a bit lower. So I'm going to, if you don't mind, go
why
ahead.
Don't I just give him the phone?
Okay, terrific. That'll work for
okay.
me.
Okay. Okay, hold on.
How do you do, sir?
Hi, Dave.
Hey. So Bernadette was telling me she would tell people he was a lawyer. Can you tell me a little bit more about his, you know, his day-to-day duties? What was he? What kind of lawyer was he?
Ralph Marino?
No. I'm sorry. William Casey.
William Casey. He was basically he did a lot of securities work and worked with the SEC. And also tax work. And he was a prolific writer. He wrote at least how many books? I don't remember how many. There's 100 cards in the library, but he wrote about 50 books on income tax.
How did you come to meet him?
I first worked with Len Hall, who was his law partner. And when Len Hall was running for... Actually, I got to know Len Hall when I did a term paper. I had to interview a public official. And then that year, I worked with Len during his campaign for governor of the state of New York, which was unsuccessful. And so Bill was also involved in that campaign. So that was... what year was that? 56, probably, yeah.
56. Would that be against, who? I mean, wasn't Rockefeller governor at that point? No?
Yes.
He was.
He was elected that year.
And your guy, Mr. Hall, was running.
Len Hall.
Len Hall was running in the primary.
No, Len Hall was running, and dropped out of it. Len Hall had been chairman of the Republican National Committee, and when he left Washington, he ran for governor of New York, and he wasn't successful, and Nelson Rockefeller was elected.
So when you were working for, you met obviously Bill Casey before you met Bernadette, right?
Yes.
And what was your relationship?
Good many years, probably.
A good many years. Where'd you go to law school, by the way?
I went to St. John's.
And where was your office with Bill Casey? Where'd you guys work?
We had an office in Greenville, Long Island, and that was the editorial office. He wrote a lot of books and had loosely services and newsletters and so on. And he had a staff that helped him on those.
What was he? How would you describe his personality? What was he like? Just in terms of his demeanor, and what was he like to work for?
Well, I found him easy to work for, but a lot of people found him hard to work for. But I found him very easy to work for, we just got along very well.
You mentioned you knew, I think Bernadette said you knew John Wydler. How did you know him? How did you know him?
Well, when I was in Albany, was with Ralph Marino, Jack was in Washington.
I knew the Wydlers lived two blocks away from me, and I knew the family a little bit. I delivered the paper there, but he was, local celebrity congressman, two blocks away. Very.
Well, he was. As I say, I knew him because he was in Washington, and Bill Casey was not Bill Casey, but Ralph Marino was in Albany, and so we had contact that way.
Sure. And did you go with Bill when he went into government?
No, I didn't.
Did you?
I didn't go. I didn't get involved with Bill at all when he was I was chief deputy county executive of Nassau County when he went into government, and I stayed as that position. And I was in that position until he died.
I'm sorry, first deputy, what were you?
Chief deputy county executive.
Did you work for, I guess Tom Gulotta was starting in 87?
No, it was Fran Purcell.
Ah, and so you, Fran Purcell, and he preceded Tom Gulotta. What did you do after that position?
After that position, I really did some writing on my own, and I did that for a couple of years, and then I
Yes. At this point, sir, I'm going to ask Bernadette if she'll tell me a little bit about how she met you, and I'm going to go on from there. So if you wouldn't mind passing the phone over. Thank you so much.
Okay.
So where were we?
Well, I was going to ask you, you were at the Riding Academy, not the Riding Academy, but you were boarding in Brentwood. Where did you go? Where did you go to college?
A small college up in White Plains called Good Counsel College.
What did you major in?
I majored in English.
Is that an all-girls school by any chance?
It was.
And
very small, all-girls, which was very popular in those years.
And you graduated in what year?
65.
Did you, after you got out of college, what was your, and obviously you had good relations with your parents. They stayed in touch and they visited throughout those years at college?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yes, very much. I came home almost every weekend.
What was your first job after college, or did you go? Did you get married right away, or did you go into the workforce?
No, I didn't get married too much later. My first job. I was a babysitter for artwork. I worked for a photographer who had a job, who had a contract with the Met to photograph some of the masters, mostly impressionist. And they would come to our shop, and I would babysit for them while they were there.
And then, what was did you have a specialty? Did you, you know, after that, you know, did you, what did you do? What was your, did you have a career?
Not really. I dabbled in acting and theater.
So,
but I wanted a career, but at this point I would say I dabbled.
How did you meet Owen?
Through my father. He worked in the office.
Did he bring him home one day, or how did it work?
I think I really got to know. He was kind of around all the time. Owen became a good friend, and then he became someone I always, you know, could count on. And somewhere along the line there, we decided we really liked each other, so we got married. Oh. But it was a long, long courtship, if you want to call it a courtship. We were just friends for a long time.
Oh, very beautiful. And, mm-hmm. you know, after your dad lost, you said his opponent was happy or something like that, but how did your dad feel about that defeat for Congress in 66?
I think he was quite happy.
He was?
Yeah, because just going around and promoting yourself every 2 years, he just couldn't imagine himself doing that.
So fast forward to the late 70s, 1980, a guy named Ronald Reagan is running for president. He ran in 76. He's a famous guy, an actor. When did your dad become associated with him?
He came, Reagan, in, I guess, 79, came out to speak to a group of people in, public officials, at Colony Hill out on Long Island. And they had, I guess it was a luncheon. And I just found out this afterwards, but Ed Meese got to talk to Dad. And Ed Meese, and I found this out on that piece that Brian Kilmeade did on the House. He said, I spoke to a fellow who was really very, you know, really sharp. I think you should talk to him, he said to Reagan. And the next morning, they had a breakfast meeting. And they just hit it off. I mean, they were very, very similar people. They both fought the communists. They loved the country. They had the same worldview. And he backed everyone in that year's election. But he worked for Reagan. And then in, I think it was February, at the, New Hampshire. At New Hampshire, Nancy called him and asked him if he would take over
the campaign.
Campaign manager.
That's right. Actually, after, I guess Reagan, I think, came in I think he actually won New Hampshire, but they were unhappy with how it went. They fired a guy named Sears, John Sears.
Correct.
And Bill Casey actually became the manager at that point.
Uh-huh. Correct. And,
which is interesting. I mean, look, he had never done anything like that before, right?
No, no. He said the day he got that call, and that was before the election, before they got the numbers from the election. He said, I think Mom was in Florida, and he came down. I was having dinner with my aunt and grandmother, and he came. No, my grandfather's passed. My aunts and uncle. And he came down and said, the country is in really bad shape, and I think I'm going to go with Reagan. And the next day, he took a plane, and they went wherever they were. I think California, but I don't know if it was still up in New Hampshire. And that was the beginning of it.
I have to back up. Nixon, he was the Securities and Exchange Chairman of the SEC from 71, I think, to about 73. Did he get to know Nixon personally?
Oh, he knew Nixon very well, yes.
Did you get to meet Nixon?
Yes.
First, what did he think of, what were your impressions of Richard Nixon?
I like Nixon, but at that point I was pretty much a kid. Nixon always came to a Christmas party at Len Hall's house and played the piano. So I thought he was a pretty good guy. I wasn't very political.
No, I understand. I have seen Nixon.
All I wanted was horses.
What did your dad, his relationship with Nixon, what was that like?
Well, he did a lot of work for Nixon to be elected. He did a lot of editorial and position books. Dad was a very prolific writer and a very clear writer, very simplified. His how-to books were, I am told, very easy to follow. So he did some work. And Owen was working alongside him there also. So
did he? All right. So back to the Reagan.
And I went to the inaugural. The claim to fame.
Did he ever express disappointment with Nixon? I mean, there were some Republicans who did, who came out and said he had to resign, that kind of thing. Do you remember the position, if any, that your father took regarding the president's troubles back then?
I think Dad thought he should stay there, should pardon them all and stay there.
So back to the campaign of 1980, what was that like for you? It's pretty exciting stuff. Your father is,
very
at one
exciting.
Point he's commuting every day to, a job in law office, and he's writing, and then he's a campaign manager for a presidential contest. What was that like for you?
It was fun. It was, I was involved in it day in and day out. It was fun.
And it was
that's not a very intellectual answer.
what else would it be for somebody like you? I mean, really, I it's good, quite frankly, that you didn't pull a Hunter Biden and try to get involved.
But Dad wanted me to come down to Washington very badly, and was trying to get me interviews here and there. I said, Dad, I don't want to go to a one-party town. I like New York. I want to stay here. So, but anyway, he always tried to. When I went to college, he asked Owen to collect colleges, the catalogs from Washington, see if he could get me to go to college there. And so he was always... So I was working an angle on that.
So I don't blame you, by the way, about Washington. It is, you know, as you said, a one-party town, a one, what do they call it, a one-industry town, government. If you're not in government, you know, it's just not the place to be.
No. And, you know, great if you're on top, if you have a good job in Washington, and if you don't, you know, you're just nothing. Dad had a friend and who I've loved. He was really great. Bill Simon. And he always called it Ugly City.
Bill Simon was the Treasury Secretary, right?
Correct. Yeah.
An Ugly City. Wow. That man had his name on every single piece of currency in the country. I always thought that was a really cool fringe benefit, but not anymore. Nobody has cash. Nobody carries cash.
Plastic.
Your dad, Reagan wins, and your father is also, I think, the main person in the transition. Do you remember anything about that, the transition in, you know, from candidate to president-elect to president? That's a big deal. Lots of jobs to fill. I don't know if he was the head man in the transition, but
I don't think he was head, but he was he was there. He was there, yeah. And he and Meese got along very well. They were really, you know, they were a good team.
How did he feel? How did the CIA job come about? Was that the job he wanted? Did he want something else? How did he feel about taking that position?
There was a rumor that he wanted Secretary of State, but I don't really think that's true. I think he spent so much time in first of OSS, so he was 30 when he was in the OSS, and that was, you know, he really loved it. He was active. He was in charge of putting spies behind German lines, and you know, that was heady stuff for him. And then when he wasn't in politics, he was always on the for many years on the PIFIAF board, which was the president's advisory on foreign affairs or something like that. It was for security, and in charge of the intelligence departments and seeing what they were doing, and, you know, kind of an ear on that for the president. And he really enjoyed that. It's some incredible. I have one thing. I got to know a lot of Dad's associates and friends. I was an only child, so I went back and forth to Washington quite a lot, or in the city. You know, I was working in the city in the later years, and I drove in, and I used to pick up Dad and take him home. So I would just meet them after work, and they would have a drink or something, and I was there, so I got to meet them. So I knew a lot of the players, both in PIFIAF and during the transition of Reagan's transition. And so I got to know them. Now, where was I leading? I don't know.
No, it's okay. That's okay. You got to, I'm sorry, who did you get to know? Let me ask you this. I don't know too much about his time as CIA director, and you could write a book about it. I know it was successful. Just what do you remember about that time from 81 to 87? He's the director of the Central Intelligence Agency, which is a kind of a, it's a, obviously a big job. A lot of fascinated people are fascinated by it. It has some mystery around
they
it.
They are fascinated. Yeah.
Right. Did you get to visit him? You went to Langley, of course, right?
I was at Langley. Yeah, I used to go down quite often to visit, and I got to know the security people. You know, because they were always around. That was really my my CIA exposure.
Was he?
He did a lot of traveling.
Mm-hmm.
And I was fortunate that I went on two of his trips. The first trip, it was funny. He called me up and said, yeah, come on, I'm going to Saudi Arabia. You know, come on with me. And I said, why do I want to go to Saudi Arabia? He said, because you can't go unless you go with me. And I said, well. So I did go, and I had just a marvelous time. So I did get a feel of what he did on his trips, and had meetings all day. And sometimes Mom came, and you know we had the ladies, and they showed us around, and we had a wonderful time.
But where else did you travel? You said two trips. Where was the other one?
Well, they both were around the world.
Oh.
Yeah, they were long trips. They were, and the second one was to China, and I said, "Yeah, I'll go to China." In fact, I think I said I would like to go to China before he invited me. So we had most of them, and it was fascinating because the. You got to meet the people in the higher echelons of the country, and got to know a feeling of their culture and the world there.
Of course, yeah. And your life, other than the occasional round the world trips, and did it change in any way in New York? Was there security for you or special communications equipment installed in the home or anything like that?
Oh, yes. At home, we had a red phone at home and to the White House. And Dad was always working. He was always working. He was always, doing something, talking to someone. So it's, and he really didn't talk about what he was doing. Well, he really didn't talk in any of his jobs about what he was doing. He'd rather talk about what we're doing or what's going on, in our little world, not the big world. So I really don't know much.
That's fine. No, neither do I, to be honest, I about those years. But I will jump ahead to as he
you,
was.
You missed one of Dad's jobs, though.
What?
Under Secretary of State.
What do you mean?
He was Under Secretary of State.
Oh, he was Under Secretary of State.
Under
Ford, right?
Yeah. Right.
For what? Let me see here. What
for economic development.
And, okay, a couple of things there. First of all, did you ever meet President Ford?
No.
What did he think about President Ford?
He's a nice man.
What about Henry Kissinger? Did you meet Henry Kissinger, who was the Secretary of State,
yeah.
I believe, at the time?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah. So wait, what was his? Yeah. All right. First off, what was your impression of him?
Kissinger?
Yeah.
The only time I really was in Dad's with Dad when he was talking to Kissinger is when he was the first campaign Kissinger was going to speak at the convention. And he came over while we were having dinner, and he said, "Neil, you don't mind how long I should speak?" And Dad told him how long he should speak. And then he said, "Okay." And he was trying to get out of bringing his speech over to Dad to read it beforehand, which everyone was doing. And he said, "Oh, you can bring it over at 9 o'clock in the morning." And Dad was very happy to say that to him. But he was a little hard to work with, I believe. And that's when Dad left the State Department.
He left, I think, in 74, right?
Yeah.
I mean, he was, and part of it, you just said it there. What's his name? Kissinger is a handful. I mean, quite frankly, he's brilliant, yeah. But nobody can take that guy, right?
Well, yeah, you know. Like, he couldn't use Kissinger's elevator. And that had none of that status thing and his personality.
Yeah.
You know, he just didn't, you know, he just took the quickest way of doing anything. And if it was on the elevator upstairs and it was his elevator, he didn't know why he couldn't use it.
I totally understand. I do have to ask you, and again, I'm not going to go into detail about his years as CIA director. I'm just not qualified to, but I would like to know, did he ever share with you thoughts about Oliver North, who I believe, I'll tell you right now, I'm a big fan of Oliver North. I met him in 2003. He became a good friend. I don't talk to him that often. I understand he was at your father's funeral, but did you ever meet Oliver North, and do you remember your dad talking about him?
I only met him at the funeral. I said something about Oliver North in the car once, and Dad kind of grumbled about something, but I don't really remember what it was. I think it was like, you know, he doesn't know. He goes too far or something like that. This was before he got into any trouble.
Okay.
Because Ollie North and I are pretty much the same age. So I was kind of curious at that. Owen has the best story about that. We were down in Washington that weekend on our way to Florida, and Ed Meese came to the door about 5 o'clock in the morning, and to speak with Dad, and he said, "Could you get Bill?" And Owen did. And he said, "I'll make a pot of coffee for you." Well, he was in the room for a while, and they started talking about Holly North and what happened and all that. And Owen said he decided he shouldn't be in the room at that time. So he went by, brewed some coffee. And Owen had the feeling, and talking to Ed afterwards, they had no inkling about what was happening. It was like the shit was hitting the fan. It was just all kind of came out, and they really didn't know the extent of what was happening. I don't know if they knew anything about it, but I don't think they did.
So I want to jump ahead to 1987, and this is what Woodward writes. There are a couple of sections here I want to go through, like two or three, but he writes that on Monday, December 15th, Casey was in his seventh floor office at Langley preparing for another appearance before the Senate Intelligence Committee when he suffered a seizure. An ambulance was summoned, and he was rushed to Georgetown Hospital. He had another seizure, but was speaking and moving normally. On Thursday at 7:40 a.m., he was taken into surgery, and a three-member team operated until 1 p.m., removing a cancerous soft tumor called a lymphoma. It was scooped out from the inner side of the left brain, the area controlling movement of the right side of the body. In a statement, his doctors said they expected that the 73-year-old Casey would be able to resume his normal activities. Number one, does that all check out with you?
Yes. A little more information than I knew, but yeah.
Let's see here. After 6 weeks, Casey improved dramatically. On Wednesday, January 28th, his deputy Gates was allowed to visit him in the hospital. He was sitting by the window. He never had much hair, so the hair loss was from radiation and drug treatment was not that noticeable. Gates had a list of subjects to cover, and he began. Casey was lucid, making short comments or grunting as Gates moved down the list. "Time for me to get out of the way," Casey finally said, waving his left arm in the air. "Make room." The next day, Gates arranged for Don...
Make room for what?
Make room, I think, for Gates to make room to get out of the way. So the next paragraph is this. The next day, Gates arranged for Don Regan and Meese to visit the hospital. Casey couldn't write, so Sophia signed his resignation letter. He had served 6 years and one day. To your understanding, did he, in fact, resign before he died?
Yes, he did.
Okay. Now, here's the part that gets very...
I don't know if he's sitting. I don't know the scenario, but he did.
This is... I understand.
Didn't he resign before he...
Yeah, he did before he died, and that's what the book says. So here's one thing, and then I'll get to the crucial part next, but here's one thing that bothers me. He writes in a very odd way, and it's full of contradictions and vagueness, in my opinion. So he says he comes up with a list of questions that he wants to ask Bill Casey. Before I go into that, why did your father cooperate with Woodward, and do you remember him talking about, you know, I'm going to talk to this guy?
I only heard that he was talking to Woodward one night. I was down there, and he called. He said, "I'm going to bring Bob Woodward over for dinner." I said, "Oh, Dad, you know, I'm not a great cook anyway." And I said, "Really?" I said, "Okay." Mom was in Florida at that time. And that was the time of the Falkland,
Falkland Islands War.
Island, whatever it was, yeah. And so they were talking about that mostly. And
did you have reservations about your father talking to Woodward? I mean, he had a bit of a reputation, didn't he?
Well, I didn't realize so afterwards that he talked to him, I think, 12 times or something like that. And I said, "Why?" He said, "Well, you know, he might write something good about me." So, but I wouldn't trust him too much. I wouldn't talk to him, but, you know, I'm a little more skittish. And Dad was open. He just, you know, he told Dad that he was writing a book about the history of the CIA. Now, he didn't present it to him as a book about him. It was a history of the CIA. So he talked to him. And then afterwards, I got a call from from Woodward, and he said he left a message on my machine saying, you know, thank you for dinner, and, you know, I'd like to repay you sometime. Give me a call. So I called Dad, and I said, hey, I got a call from Woodward for a dinner. And Dad said, well, go with him and say something nice about me. I said, no, I don't think that's going to happen. So, but no, I was right about him.
You were right about him. You didn't trust him.
Yeah. No.
Why not?
I didn't.
Why didn't you, what was the feel?
Something about his eyes. Something, I mean, he, you know, it was, he wasn't listening. He was like, well, now that I know the book, I would say conniving. But he wasn't, you know, if you're really interested in something, you look at a person one way. And he wasn't looking at Dad that way. It was odd. I don't know. I saw something in him that I was suspicious of.
So let me take you back to the book he wrote. And this is just an odd couple of lines, in my opinion. Let's see.
First of all, he never got into the hospital.
He didn't get into the hospital.
It's absolutely impossible.
Why is that?
We had security outside the door. 24/7. Either my mother or I were there every day. Mom took the night shift, and I was the day shift. If on weekends, if we, you know, wanted to do something or sleep in, Owen was there, and he took over. But we never left Dad alone. His scenario of light coming in the window, well, that wasn't his room. There was an anteroom just before his room. And his description is nowhere near what the room was like or the sun coming into the room. He wrote an ending, actually a scenario ending that would be good for a movie. And that's why I think he wanted to make a movie out of it.
He wanted to make a movie out of it, which he had done
before. Well, that's by Samantha.
Yeah. Sure. So there's this odd couple of lines here. You say he wasn't in the hospital. Everything I'm reading in his book suggests or tells me that you're right. This is just a weird part. He says this. Let's see. He had a he went to the hospital. He came up with some questions. He drove over to Georgetown Hospital. Georgetown Hospital, yeah, and here it goes. Two unusually heavy snowfalls had blanketed Washington during the latter part of the month, and the traffic was thin. I didn't have to wait long in the lobby to see one of the telltale CIA security men through his walkie-talkie earpiece stroll through. He went down a long corridor, turned left into a new wing, and took the elevator. It stopped at the sixth floor. I went up. In a small room, four CIA security men were watching television. Casey was in room C6316, registered under the alias Lacey. The door was closed, and after I identified myself, the lone security man declined to let me in. So that's one portion right there. And it's just an odd way to report it. He says, you know, there are four CIA security men watching television. And then he jumps to the lone security man declined to let him in. I found that odd and just, again, slightly vague. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so here's... And then he goes back to the hospital a few pages later, and there's no discussion of security. He just walks in. This is what he writes. He has a pad with him. Under the last question on key unanswered questions for Casey, I wrote, do you now see that it was wrong? Kind of a presumptuous question, don't you think?
Yes, I do.
All right, so he writes this. Several days later, I returned to Casey's hospital room. The door was open. Scars from the craniotomy were still healing. I asked Casey how he was getting along. Hope and then realism flashed in his eyes. Okay, better, no. I took his hand to shake it in a greeting. He grabbed my hand and squeezed. Peace and sunlight in the room for a moment. You finished yet? He asked, referring to the book. I said I'd never finish, never get it all. There were so many questions. I'd never find out everything he had done. The left side of his mouth hooked up in a smile, and he grunted. Look at all the trouble you've caused, I said. The whole administration under investigation. He didn't seem to hear, so I repeated it, and for a moment he looked proud, raising his head. It hurts, he said, and I thought he was in physical pain. What hurts, sir? Oh, he said, stopping. He seemed to be saying that it was being out of it, out of the action, I thought. But suddenly he spoke up, apparently on the same track about the hurt. What you don't know, he said. In the end, I realized what was hidden was greater. The unknown had the power. He seemed to be saying, or at least that's what I thought. He was so frail, at life's edge, and he knew making a comment about death. I'm gone, he said. I said no. You knew, didn't you? I said. The contradiversion had to be the first question. You knew all along. His head jerked up hard. He stared and finally nodded, yes. Why? I asked. I believed. What? I believed. Then he was asleep, and I didn't get to ask another question.
Didn't happen.
Did not happen?
Dad couldn't speak. Dad never said a word after he came out of the operating room.
Never said a word.
When
this was published, what did you think? Were you angry? What was your reaction?
We were coming. Mom, Owen, and I went up to visit friends in New Hampshire, and we're coming down, and I think it was Labor Day weekend. And there was somebody selling a New York Post newspaper at the where you paid going on to the Long Island Expressway. So Bob said, "Stop! I want to get a paper," and she got it, and it was deathbed confession. She sat very quietly in the back, and she read it. And God bless her, she was amazing. She, as soon as she got home, she got on the phone very quietly, got on the phone, called CBS, and told me she wanted to be on 60 Minutes to oppose Woodward on his. What he's saying in his new book. Well, CBS said, no, you can't do that because you can't do that. And so after that, she called up, remember Morality in the Media? It was one of my mother's friends. And he got many newspapers and radio shows to call Mom, and she did an interview. And she was up to about 2 o'clock. I think the last one was Australia that called in. And one by one, she talked to them, and she refuted what Bob said in the newspaper article. And she was a fighter. Boy, she was fierce. And my mother was a pretty, restrained gal. She really wasn't rah-rah for any cause or anything like that. So she, except for Bill Casey, that was her cause. And the next day we got a call from, I can't remember, Hugh Downs, is it? Is that, no, that
could
was
be Hugh Downs from ABC, yeah.
It was, yeah, it was Ian.
He was on television at 2020 at that time.
This was 60 Minutes.
Okay.
I can't remember the top guy there. But anyway, he said it was in the contract that Bob Woodward would not have anybody on the show that would oppose anything he said. So, Hugh Downs?
I don't think Hugh Downs was at CBS at the time. Let's see. You said he was the guy running it. What was that guy's name again? He was died a few years ago. I'll find it here in a second. But
yeah. But anyway,
Hugh was it? Oh, I know. Hugh Hewitt.
Who?
Hugh Hewitt, I think his name was. Maybe not. Let's see.
I don't think so. Anyway, he said, you know, he said he couldn't do it. But if Mom wanted to go on the show the next week, she could. Mom, she said no. But we did a lot of shows. She did a lot of radio appearances. It just, you know, for
was it Don Hewitt?
Fight.
Don Hewitt.
That doesn't sound right.
Okay.
I think it was Hugh Downs.
So, but she was done at that point. She had done all the interviews she wanted to do?
Oh, no. She went on for days and days and days. And, but she just didn't leave it go. And
how did she feel about Bob Woodward?
A liar. You know, can't be trusted. I didn't think much of him at all. But she really put it to him, and they always. All the news people who she talked to wanted her to talk about different points in the book, and she said, "I don't know anything substantial about anything else that he did at the CIA. He never brought home, but I do know about when he was very sick and dying." That no one got into the room and spoke to him. Besides, he couldn't really, even those little words that he couldn't do. And I used to try to make him. I used to try to make him read. That was just impossible. And because I was of the belief that he was going to come back and be strong and go back to work, and or maybe not go back to work but be strong and we would still have him. But it wasn't to be.
And did you ever get an apology? Did he acknowledge your concerns? Did he fight back? Did you hear from Woodward again?
No, not at all. No.
Now, when he pops up in the news these days, for instance, tape was released, and now they'll say, well, it's all on tape. 18 interviews with the president, President Trump. What struck me, fascinatingly, I thought, and very few people have picked up on this, if anybody, from 18 interviews, he only released 4 minutes or so of conversation, and most of it is Bob Woodward talking, not the president. And it seems like the president is cut off mid-thought. I mean, if he said, yeah, I want to play it down. I always wanted to play it down. Well, what did he say next? What did he say right after that? He said, on the tape, he said, I didn't want to create a panic. But what came next? And I just found it oddly selective.
They all do that.
They do, don't they? Can I just say this to your about your mom? By the way, I've heard it pronounced different ways. Sophia, it would be the typical way, but I've also Sophia. How did you say your name?
Sophia.
Oh, Sophia. Okay. Where is she from? Where did she grow up?
She grew up on Long Island.
So your mother did an amazing job because the pushback was so intense. You know, I remember it. I wasn't really following the case that closely at the time. I was in high school in 1987. Wow. But every time Woodward comes up and makes a splash, I always think about that alleged hospital visit and that it, your family, and now I know for sure it didn't happen. So she did a remarkable job.
Oh, she did. She absolutely did. She was incredible, and you know, there's some people, because we were down in Washington for, well, from it happened December 15th until I guess March, a little after March, and you know, some people we didn't hear from, and I would say, gee, I'm really surprised we didn't hear from la-da-dee-da. And she said, really? And, you know, these were supposedly very good friends. At least Dad thought so, but they were good time friends.
Good time friends. But I'm sorry, you didn't hear from them after he died, or you didn't hear from them when?
No, when he was in the hospital.
When he was in the hospital. Now, is that because, let's face it, Reagan was, at that point, you know, Iran-Contra was a big deal, and there was controversy surrounding the White House and questions being raised about your dad. Do you think that's why they were staying away? And to your
probably.
Point, good time friends, right?
Probably. Yeah, probably.
That's a shame.
But friends don't do that if they're really friends.
You know, it's also interesting when you're going through something, who you pick up the phone for. You know, sometimes friends, it's, you know, they say you know who your friends are by who calls in a time of crisis. And I've actually, it's not necessarily the case. We've all gone through tough times, and sometimes I know the phone will ring, and I think it's somebody just looking for gossip so they can tell their friends they talk to you. Then another time, so it's who you pick up the phone for. And now you know who's calling ahead of time. It's not like the old days, the phone rang. You had no idea who was on the other side.
Right.
Interesting.
Right.
Just a couple of, a couple more minutes, if you don't mind. So,
no, this is fun.
Oh, thank you. Thank you. I guess, oh, you mentioned the, there's no way the light, he talked about the light coming into the room. And let me actually just find that for a second. I know I just read it. Grab my hand, squeezed. You finish left. Under the last question. Took his hand and shake it in. Look at the whole time. He didn't seem to hear. It hurts. I'm just looking for the part where he said the light. All right, let me just go back here a couple more pages. I'm sorry. I don't know. I'm going to have to take it from the top. I just say, several days I returned to Casey's hospital room. The door is open. Scars from his craniotomy are still healing. I asked Casey how he's getting along. Hope and then realism flashed in his eyes. I shook his hand in greeting. He grabbed my hand and squeezed. Peace. I took his hand to shake it in a greeting. He grabbed my hand and squeezed. Peace and sunlight in the room for a moment. Well, there was no sunlight in the room. You were quite clear about that. Although I guess he could be speaking metaphorically here.
Well, yeah, I except that it was, the whole thing is a matter. He wasn't there. But I think, if I mean, it's a long time ago, and I think there was a wall or something that just blocked the sun. I don't remember sun coming into the room. So that could have been.
How much pain did this inflict on your family, this false story? You told me already about your mom and her resolve, and she waged a counterattack, and that was very, very impressive. But did this episode inflict pain, or was it just so fantastic and utterly incredible, this chapter here, that it was more of a farce and a joke?
I think we were so mad. Yeah, I think we were more mad and trying to correct it more than pain. And it hurt Mom. It hurt Mom. I was just mad. I mean, I used to run down to Washington all the time when there was a bad headline or a bad story, which there were a lot. And Dad said, "Don't worry about it. It's just going to be gone tomorrow. You know, there's nothing to it." It's hurtful. It's hurtful.
Bob Woodward is now like the most famous journalist in America. What does that tell you? What does that tell you about journalism, if anything? I mean, his status and how he is continues to churn out these books, and he goes on all the shows, and he gets celebrated.
I think that's the beginning of the cancer, the canceled culture that we're living in now. Whatever he could put together to make something sensational, he'll do it. And I don't know how they're going to bring things around that people really study about the world and our history. Of course, he was way ahead of that. I just don't believe anything he writes. He really has come a long way on nothing. Well, the only story I really know fully is Dad's, but I haven't thought about this in so long. I forgot how mad I used to be. It was quite a fight.
Well, it's a fight I believe you won. I really do. People know and people remember. I know he was a great man, and I know he didn't do what is alleged to have been done, and this is one of the cheapest, dirtiest tricks I've ever seen in my life, to go in there or to pretend to go in there and take advantage of a man in that condition who led such an exemplary life.
Yeah. Besides, he couldn't talk to him. I mean, I tried to get him to talk to me, you know, day in and day out for 6 months. And he just didn't get anything out. I mean, there was something there. One thing he said before he went into the operations the night before, he said, "You know, I've never done anything in my life without knowing exactly what it is I'm getting into." And he said, I don't understand this at all. And he said, "Oh, you're going to be okay. You know, you'll be, you know, laid up for a while, but you'll be okay. You'll be back to work." So he just, you know, he felt like he had to go on that, and he did. But his that weekend before, he wasn't quite himself. He wasn't. And he was at that weekend. It happened on a Monday. That weekend, he went to his doctor, and his doctor said he wasn't quite right, but he didn't pick up on it. Mm-hmm. And then he was saying his eyesight wasn't what it used to be, and he went to optometrist who said that he didn't find anything, except afterwards he said to Owen, I thought I saw something in his eyes, like a tumor, but this fellow had a tumor a year before that, and he said, I'm seeing things. And he just, you know, let it go. So he was tired at that point, and he was pretty sick.
What would you but like? What would you two more questions? First question is, what if somebody came to you and said, "Hey, I just heard from Bob Woodward, and they want to interview me about something I'm working on and involved in." Seems like, you know, wow, this is an opportunity for me, you know, to get my story out there, because he's a very successful author. I should probably talk to him, right? What would you say?
I wouldn't do it. I see him on television. I really can't watch him, but I do catch him every once in a while. And I just don't feel like it's kind of soily. I don't know. I just don't like him. I just don't trust him.
What about your dad? I think is his most admirable trait. If somebody, we have a daughter, she's 7 months old. High hopes for her. You told me that your dad, if you wanted to go to the movies, he'd go to the movies. If you wanted to get an ice cream cone, he'd be up for getting an ice cream cone, which I thought was really nice. And it's something I'm going to try to employ that kind of readiness when my daughter's old enough. But what's something about your dad that you'd like folks to remember more than anything else?
He was interested in people. He liked people. He would listen to people and what they're doing and what they were involved in. I had a friend here who did a high school paper. And he said, "That sounds interesting. Let me read it." And he sat in the corner and he read it. My friend, who now is a priest, he said, "I don't think anyone else ever read that paper. Maybe the teacher, but I don't." But he was. I had a pool guy. Who was an undercover cop, and he went down and he spoke to him, and just wanted to know about people and what they did, and he was very generous with his friends, and it was fun, but never really talked about what he was doing or what was up. He would talk about the world and what was happening in the world. he was, I enjoyed, we enjoyed being with him. Owen and I always, we used to, they were the, our favorite people to double date with. Because there was always, you know, he always had something, little tidbits that were fun.
She's a really great woman. I so enjoy talking to her, and I'm so grateful that she opened up about that chapter in her life and other chapters as well. So thanks for listening, folks. We will have another podcast up soon. And also, I urge you to check out the Greg Kelly Report show on Newsmax TV, available basically wherever you get cable, or you can go to Newsmax.com, and I'm at Greg Kelly USA on Twitter. So thank you again to Bernadette Casey Smith, to her husband, Owen, and thank you. See you next time.